When they were putting together the programme and the adverts for today's meeting, they had Rodney Down as an astrophysicist, Dennis Down as a molecular biologist, but didn't know what to put me down as. I would have gone for International Man of Mystery, but it wouldn't fit on the page, unfortunately.
A friend of mine suggested really cool guy.
Well, I'm not a scientist, and no, I'm not a theologian, and no, you can't have your money back. Half the time, I'm the pastor of a small Baptist church just a couple of miles up the road in Palmer's Green. And the other half of the time, I'm the administrator of a small Christian development charity called Operation Agri. And the other half of the time, I'm a foster carer for the London Borough of Enfield. And I ought to say that nothing that I say today should be assumed to represent the views of any of the above. So, introduction. When we went to see the end of the world, a lot of people have asked me if that's something to do with Douglas Adams and the restaurant at the end of the universe, and regrettably it's not. It's a short story by Robert Silverberg, first published in 1972. And in the story, a decadent group of 20 and 30-somethings meet for one of their regular parties and discuss their recent holidays. It turns out they've all been on the same trip. It's a new and very expensive expedition in a time machine to see the end of the world. And as they discuss their experiences, they realise that although they all paid for the same holiday, they all witnessed completely different things. One of them saw the death of the last living creature, a crab-like thing crawling across an empty beach. Now, one of them saw the last mountain crumbling into the sea. One of them saw the whole planet coated in its own frozen atmosphere. One of them saw the sun go nova. And one of them saw the moon disintegrate, its fragments falling to Earth in a great storm of giant meteorites. In the first chapter of the book, The End of the World and the Ends of God, that's edited by John Polkinghorne and Michael Walker, it's by a chap called W.R. Stoger, which I'm almost certainly pronouncing wrongly, and it's called Scientific Accounts of Ultimate Catastrophes in Our Life-Bearing Universe. And that introduces some other possibilities, including a very distant but apparently inescapable decline of the universe towards a state of heat death or heat, you know, annihilation by crunching back together again. In the heat death world, not only all living things have died, but matter itself has decayed into an expanding cloud of low-grade radiation, which doesn't sound like something particularly to look forward to. So which is the real end of the world or end of the cosmos? Or are all of them, in their own ways, endings worthy of the name? And then what about the end of the universe in the sense of what it's for or its chief purpose? And these obviously are different questions. Science is neither atheistic nor theistic. It's by its very nature agnostic. And to misquote Alastair Campbell, science doesn't do God. It is the scientists, not the science itself, who decide whether to be a Dawkins or a Polkinghorne. And the decision has to be made on grounds other than scientific. Skating on thin ice. I'm not in the way of this by any chance, am I? No, good. As Christians committed to developing a biblical outlook, we have an interest not only in what science anticipates as the future end of the world, but also in what our faith has to say on the same subject. And here we can be on potentially controversial ground. If you think about the example of evolution, even talking about this sort of thing is a risky process in Baptist circles where I come from. There's still a lot of anti-evolutionary sentiment out there, held from passionate conviction and a desire to be loyal to Christ and his word. So you can't mock it, but even to ask the question could be a career-limiting move in the sort of conservative circles where I tend to feel theologically most at home. Yet surely we want to be as radically biblical as we can, and that means challenging our accepted understandings of the Bible, if the Bible itself requires us to do so, from signs in the text itself and from improved exegesis. And we do this not so that we can accommodate the Bible to other things, whether that's science or current cultural shifts, tempting though that is. And you can sometimes see that at work in commentaries, which in my line of work I have to look at a lot. And you see examples of when people have come across a text which contradicts current cultural assumptions, and that's when people tend to go into more depth. The result tends to be, as a result of this historical or literary attention, that the text doesn't mean what we all obviously thought it meant, but actually means the exact opposite, and fits in rather well with current cultural trends. Now, ideally, that arises from a deep appreciation of the text, but you can't help wondering whether the same effort would have been made if it hadn't been culturally awkward at the time of writing. And it would also be nice if, from time to time, the deep exegesis resulted in us saying, well, actually, it means what we always thought it meant, sorry. Something similar is a risk when seeking to read the Bible in such a way as to make sense of it within a scientific, which usually means modernist, philosophical framework. The relationship between the book of Genesis and the geological and biological sciences has been dealt with from every conceivable point of view, and every possible conclusion has been reached. And the debate is well summarised in Dennis's book, this one with the monkey on the front, Creation or Evolution, Do We Have to Choose? And I was apologising to Dennis earlier, I can't see him now, I was up back there. Apologising to Dennis earlier, I did want to go through and make sure that everything I say about his book is right, but I gave it away to someone 2 weeks ago, so I haven't had a chance to do that. So feel free to shoot me down in flames, but hopefully the hands the book's been put into will benefit from it particularly, perhaps more than I would have done just going through checking I've got everything right. Creation or evolution, do we have to choose? And I know from experience that for many evangelical Christians, the answer is yes, we do. For the more atheistically inclined, the answer is the same, although for the opposite reason. I happen to agree with Dennis's conclusions in the main, for what it's worth, and in large parts of the evangelical world, that would make me an unemployable, wishy-washy, liberal, backsliding apostate. Even though, like Dennis, I reached those conclusions not despite the biblical witness, but because of it, seeking to treat the text as the text itself demands to be treated. But your mileage may vary. With Genesis, for most of our history, we took it as a reasonably straightforward, if metaphorical, description of what happened when God made the heavens and the earth. Because we had no choice, there was no real alternative. Now, on the other hand, we have other ancient texts, which, while they don't have priority for us over the text of Scripture, do nevertheless cast clear and relevant light on Genesis. And on the other hand, we have the filings of geology and evolutionary biology. We have had, if we follow Dennis and all the others, to rethink Genesis, not to avoid the clash with science, but to be faithful to what the text was always saying, even if we did not have the necessary knowledge available to us before. Now, something similar to the process of biblical, theological, and scientific thinking that is summarized in Dennis's book needs to be done equally thoroughly for the last things of Christian eschatology. Here, however, we're in potentially just as much danger. In creationist circles, there are, I understand, two main approaches: young earth, literal six-day creation, and old earth, days are ages creation. You probably already know how many approaches there are to the last things among conservative Christians, some particularly popular in one denomination or another, or in one country or another. And anyone asking whether not just one or the other, but maybe all of these might be missing the point, is going to be shot by all sides. Still, what's the point of a parapet if you're not going to stick your head up over it? Which end, which world? When the Bible speaks of the end of the world or cosmos, what's it referring to? What are we to make of judgment, the second coming, the general resurrection, or the new heavens and the new earth in the light of current scientific thinking, let alone the rapture, the tribulation, or any of the other aspects which mean so much to so many people? How, if at all, does this thinking relate to our understanding of the various ends science anticipates for our species, our planet, our star, and our universe? What happens if we take the process we followed with Genesis and both cosmic and human origins and do the same thing with eschatology in general and apocalyptic in particular? This talk is not the answer to that question, but it's just asking the question in the hope that somebody will one day write that book. I've already been told it ought to be me. I don't think I have the theological chops to be able to do that, but I would like to see someone have a go. For instance, in Dennis's book, he argues that the description of the Great Flood has a touch of rhetorical hyperbole about it. The water did not literally cover Mount Everest to a depth of several fathoms, as it says in Genesis 7:19, but it was a really big flood that changed the face of the world for those who were affected by it. The universal visibility of Christ's return, an idea that's drawn from Acts 1, Matthew 24, and particularly Revelation 1:7, could be hyperbole in the same sort of way. Something like that is bound to attract it. How else can you describe the indescribable? And if it wasn't absolutely universally visible, how many people who are sure that it will be refuse to believe it? if it's seen by everyone but the British Antarctic Survey team and a few million penguins, let alone if seeing here is being understood in altogether the wrong sense. When our foster daughter was 9, and I have permission to tell this story, by the way, and only recently arrived with us, she came in from the garden complaining that she'd been trapped on the trampoline for an hour. There were 11 foxes running around under the trampoline. 11! She couldn't get off. Now, I was watching her the whole time, and sure enough, one fox did run across the back of the garden at one point and startle her, and she didn't get off the trampoline for a few minutes. Which description is more accurate? One fox or 11 foxes? 5 minutes or 1 hour? Her description might not have been very literally accurate, but that does not invalidate it. It was more forceful, more vivid, and more emotionally honest than a pedantically literal narrative. Theodore Sturgeon, another science fiction writer, once said, "Sometimes a whole bunch is a more accurate description than 6, particularly when describing the gang who mugged you." So in what sense does the cosmos have a purpose? Can a thing even have a purpose? It's not a quantifiable property. If such a purpose exists, does it arise from the essential nature of the thing itself and from someone's perception or appreciation of the thing? Does a galaxy as a galaxy have a purpose? Or do electrons? The creation does not groan as in the pains of childbirth, Romans 8:22. In any literal sense, we groan over its bondage to decay, and we hope for a new heaven and a new earth. In fact, in the previous verse, Paul says the creation will be set free into our freedom. And to me, it seems, as an interested amateur, that statements about purpose or meaning or goals have at their heart the assumption that these things reside within the observer and not within the thing itself. Now, of course, we as Christians would think of God as the ultimate observer, but also we ourselves observe and we ourselves perceive significance and purpose. But without us, these things, they don't have a purpose. It's not a property that you could measure. Perhaps this is even part of what we mean by being in the image of God, because ultimately meaning and purpose derive from the Creator, if they exist at all, and we are reimagining God's thoughts after him. God did not become an electron or a galaxy, but a human being full of grace and truth. This property of the cosmos may not be measurable, but that's hardly a problem. A lot of interesting things can't be quantified, usually because they are in the brain of the beholder. The answer to the question, "How beautiful am I?" from my wife is, "But soft, what light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Linda is the dawn." The answer is emphatically not 0.16 Juliets. With some interesting properties of the world, to quantify them would be to spoil them. Our perceptions, our brains, are such a part of the thing being measured that it doesn't exist at all without us. A thing can have mass and extension of itself, but not beauty. In the Discworld novel Moving Pictures, Terry Pratchett describes a device invented by a previous professor at the Unseen University called Rictor. I'm going to quote, I'm not sure I can do the voices justice, but the Arch-Chancellor tapped the pot with his knuckles. "What? Old numbers, Rictor? Same fella?" "Apparently, Arch-Chancellor." "Total madman! Thought you could measure everything. Not just lengths and weights and that kind of stuff, but everything. If it exists, he said, you ought to be able to measure it." Reed Cully's eyes misted with memory. "Made all kinds of weird widgets. Reckoned you could measure truth and beauty and dreams and stuff. So this is one of old Rictor's toys, is it? Wonder what it measured." That afternoon, a couple of porters moved the universe's only working risograph into the Arch-Chancellor's study. A risograph is a device for measuring disturbances in the fabric of reality. Now, mathematical entities exist, if that's the right word for what they do, regardless of whether or not we are here to discover and enjoy them. They have that Platonic side to them. We've already thought a little bit about that. Art, music, beauty, these things exist only in the enjoyment of them. Without us, or an observer at least of some kind, they are empty of meaning. And it seems to me that physics occupies the borderlands between these two, because it's observational but real, right on the edge between objective and subjective, with mathematics as the metaphorical language we use to describe the cosmos that we can observe and measure. Unmixing our metaphors. all abstract language is essentially metaphorical. Without metaphor, we have no way to speak about beauty, love, art, or music. And all theological language is also metaphorical. Its nature as revelation only amplifies that. This distinction between the metaphorical landscapes of physics and theology is analogous to traditional ideas of first and second causes. Again, an idea we've come to before today. Science is agnostic and recognizes no first cause in itself, but that tends to mean it goes towards reductionism as a result. Second causes are a complete and consistent explanation of causality. That's kind of the point of science, isn't it? That's what justifies the entire scientific project. But they have nothing to say about questions of significance, meaning, or purpose. It isn't even possible to ask the question within that way of thinking. The scientific explanation of love or art or beauty tends to be astonishingly unsatisfying, fundamentally disconnected from the experience itself, and therefore missing the point entirely. Theological thinking embraces second causes as part of a description of how the world works, but it prefers thinking about the first cause. And I was going to explain it, but I don't mean that pushing the red button that starts the universe, but being behind everything, but we've already covered that. It's the difference between event time and significance time, or filled time. And although the two appear poles apart, that's an illusion. Science is a source of wonder. You only have to look through a telescope at the planet Saturn to appreciate that. Theology is one of the sciences of the unquantifiable faces of reality. Both are true, and both are interesting in the sense of not being trivial, and both are built from metaphor. Metaphor links incommensurate things, that's its point. Both theology and science are metaphors of reality, one experimental and general, the other experiential and particular, and that complementarity enables them to keep each other in check. This can be a great source of confusion if we don't watch our step. We read the Bible and it reminds us of science. We read science and it reminds us of the Bible. And this is metaphorical thinking in two different domains which overlap in the source but not in the target. If we are not careful, the fact that this reminds me of that transforms itself into this actually is that. This isn't a mistake we would make with metaphors we use on a daily basis, but we're dealing with two worlds of ideas, and few of us are equally at home in both. Going back to Genesis and cosmology for a moment, the similarities between them are superficially so strong as to provoke all sorts of unfortunate mistaking of metaphor and analogy for equivalence. At least with the last things, we don't have that problem. The metaphorical nature of theological discourse has always been recognized. Calvin called it God's condescension to speak to us in terms we can understand, like lisping to a baby. In metaphor, we start from things we know from our own experience and find descriptions for things that go beyond that. In theological thinking, we also take an additional step, and that's to reverse the abstraction. For example, we love our children. To understand how God relates to us, we call him Father, the one who loves us as we love our children. But to avoid this being an intrinsically unstable extrapolation, God is like us, only bigger, we take the conclusion and make that the premise. So God's love is the real love, ours is derived from his. All families take their true name from him rather than the reverse. We are like him, but dependent on him. And this gives a strongly monotheistic foundation to our thinking. God is subject, not object, and ultimately everything derives from him. And whether this comes through a process of revelation from above, or a particularly clear form of definitively monotheistic thinking, ultimately makes no difference, because these are two different ways of saying the same thing, top down and bottom up, like the difference in the approach to Christology between the Synoptics and the Fourth Gospel. Top-down and bottom-up theology both reach the opposite terminus in the end. As we developed language, and here I'm drawing on Dennis's book again, as we developed language, so the revelation could deepen, or so the reverse analogical process could deepen. These are two different and complementary ways of describing the same thing. Scientifically, the end of the world, especially the end of the human world, could come in any one of a dozen clearly quantifiable ways. Theologically, the end is going to be something that is not measurable in that way, but is focused more on hope and the transformation of life in love. I am particularly proud of this title. Some Hope, because it could be some hope, or it could be some hope, or it could be some hope. There you go, you think about that for a bit. Although in the Bible this eschatological hope extends to the animal kingdom and indeed to the whole created order, the primary focus is on mankind's response to the coming of God and God's gracious response to our need for him to come. So much so that the animal and cosmic dimensions of that hope could easily be seen as extrapolations or universalizing analogies of the transformation to come along the lines mentioned above. Perhaps we can even go one step further and say that the cosmic transformation is more a transformation of our perception of or involvement with the cosmos as part of that cosmos rather than a change in the cosmos itself. So when Christ returns, should we expect to see a change in the fundamental constants or perhaps in the very laws of physics? We have no reason to think that they changed at the fall, although some would say that they did. The incarnation, the cross, the resurrection, or the ascension. So perhaps we should assume that as far as science is concerned, it will continue to be business as usual. So what will have changed? What changed with all the other things? Nothing? Or everything? The universe changed when I became a Christian at university, in that I changed, and I'm part of the universe, but I also began to see the cosmos in a new and vibrant way, and that was part of that change. There's a hymn by George Wade Robinson that I've never heard sung for about the last 30 years, but I remember singing it shortly after I became a Christian. And it's got the verse, "Heaven above is softer blue, earth around is sweeter green. Something lives in every hue Christless eyes have never seen. Birds with gladder songs o'erflow, flowers with deeper beauties shine. Since I know, as now I know, I am his. And he is mine." That's from "Loved with an Everlasting Love." Now that's my testimony. That's what happened to me. It's not something that could be measured unless perhaps you put my head in a functional MRI scanner while it was happening. And even that wouldn't really explain it. It would just give you some numbers to wrap around it. But just because it can't be measured, it's no less real. So from this point of view, we're not necessarily talking about any of the physical ends of the world, but more of a transition from humanity as it now is to humanity as it will be in some way, realizing the longing to walk with God in the cool of the evening and to know as we are known. It's the end, Jim, but not as we know it. According to the New Testament, the great theological truths have always been true, like the Lamb of God slain from the foundation of the world in Revelation 13:8, for example. They have the nature not of timelessness, but of time fullness, becoming instantiated in time in the progressive way, which is the only way we have of engaging with time at particular points in our history. And if these theological events were always the case, but became historical at a particular moment for us, something similar should be true for the consummation, the return of Christ, and the remaking of all things. And even if these things deal more with the human perception and interaction with creation than with any essential change in creation itself, what will they look like? And here we are, as N.T. Wright puts it, looking at a signpost pointing into a shining fog. The signpost is true and reliable, but it's only the sign, not the substance. A metaphor is the only language we have for something so utterly new. I've often heard the apocalyptic events of the Bible described as if they are, for instance, thermonuclear war, that's going back to the 80s more, or these days more, if it's an asteroid impact. But if you're going to describe something that is the darkest hour before the dawn for the whole human race, let alone perhaps for the entire cosmos, what other metaphors are you going to reach for but war, disease, and natural disaster suddenly overturned? So I think we need a similar process to the one followed with Genesis and cosmology. We need to be as careful as we can to identify and interpret the genres of the texts correctly. We need some idea of the worldview they are undermining from a monotheistic or Trinitarian perspective. And we need to remember that the scientific description itself is open to revision, but from new experimental evidence and analysis, not from theological or biblical critique. With apocalyptic literature, we struggle to understand partly because we do not know enough about the metaphorical background to the text. We are like, and you wondered when this is going to come up, didn't you? We are like Captain Picard in the Star Trek The Next Generation episode, Darmok. The Temerian's language is impossible to understand because although the words make sense, they're all names of people and places and things happening. They're drawn from ancient stories which are unknown to the captain, and so they have absolutely no way of communicating with each other. I was going to show about a minute and a half of video of that.
Captain, would you be prepared to consider the creation of a mutual non-aggression pact between our two peoples? possibly leading to a trade agreement and cultural interchange. Does this sound like a reasonable course of action to you?
Kader beneath, Momata.
Everybody, Mark! In winter!
Impressions, number one. It appears they're trying their best, as are we, for what it's worth.
Shaka, when the walls fell. Darmok. Darmok. Rai and Jiri at Lunga. Shaka, when the walls fell. Xena at Anzo. Xena and Bakar. Darmok at Tanagra. Shaka, Mirab, his sails unfurled. Darmok. Mirab. Tamok. The river, Tamok. Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra.
Who knows what Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra means? This is actually on the telly about a week and a half ago, so that's a repeat. Yeah. Now, we know what it means, presumably because we've seen the programme, yes? And we understand that everything they say is drawn from the mythical stories that underline their civilization. And this particular one is actually identical to a story in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which Picard himself draws upon towards the end of the story. But without knowing the background story of Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra, you would have no idea what it meant. I'm not going to tell you in case you watch it, because it will surprise you. It'll spoil the whole surprise of the episode, so, and what the whole thing's about. So go and download it for yourself. Without knowing the stories behind the metaphors, the Temerian language remains completely incomprehensible. And to an extent, we struggle to understand apocalyptic for similar reasons. Above all, we need to find a theology of endings and new beginnings that is honest to the understanding of the Bible that the form and history demand, and which deepens without undermining our scientific understanding of the ultimate death of everything. And when thinking about life and death and hope, as Christians, we naturally turn to the resurrection of Christ as the first fruits and then of all people. And we also think about the remaking of the heavens and the earth and the coming down of the New Jerusalem and the lion lying down with the lamb. And I've already given reasons for seeing these potentially as rhetorically hyperbolic extensions of our future human experience of God. But whatever approach we take to miracles, and I rather like C.S. Lewis's idea that they represent not so much exceptions to the laws of physics as changes in the boundary conditions upon which these laws act, in the resurrection of the Son of Man, we have one of those time-full events which was always true, but which was realised at a particular time and place in our history. And in the New Testament, this event is not unique in itself, but only in its priority. It anticipates resurrection as God's general response to death in the fullness of time, and generalises to the entire suffering, decaying cosmos. In the discussion of the resurrected body of Jesus in the Gospels and Acts and our own future resurrected bodies in 1 Corinthians 15, we see both continuity and change. Continuity of the conscious identity of the individual, but change and transformation to be fitted for a new and different kind of existence in a new and different kind of cosmos. And if, as I've tried to argue, the cosmic change is not in the cosmos itself, but in our perception and experience of it as people fully reconciled to God, the key element in the transformation is a renewal in humanity itself in God. Jesus had emptied himself in the incarnation and was refilled, crucified and risen. In our own death and resurrection, or transformation in God, we were always empty, but we are filled in him. The Bible makes the general resurrection universal and simultaneous, at least in most people's reading of it, and that makes it a species-wide event, like a mass extinction in reverse. How we unravel the metaphors will vary from person to person, but I can see two main ways forward here. Firstly, a sort of evolutionary step, along the same lines as the one Dennis argues for as the first self-revelation of God to our ancient ancestors. Once our brains had reached a level of complexity, perhaps language too, God began to speak to us. God began to lisp to our infant ears, as Calvin would have said, in ways that we could start to understand. Perhaps there's more than one step in that process. Now that our evolution appears to be largely in the world of ideas and culture rather than biology, perhaps another such step is on its way when that reaches a critical point. And if this all sounds rather Age of Aquarius, Steven Pinker argues in his book The Better Angels of Our Nature that for all of recorded human history, now pin your ears back because you're not going to believe this, for all of recorded human history, we are becoming less violent, less bloodthirsty, and less cruel, and that this process is not slowing down. No, I didn't believe it either. But he makes a very persuasive case. It's an enormously big book, but I have a tackle of it. Very, very interesting book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. The other possibility is that the general resurrection is the other side of the coin of a literal mass extinction. It would be enormously ironic if the people who say that the apocalypse is an asteroid strike turned out to be right after all. But if we believe in the resurrection of Christ and the future resurrection of the dead, why not the resurrection of a species? Perhaps the coming of Christ is another way of looking at our transformation in him through death to a new kind of life on the other side of the end of our species as we currently know it. One of the characteristics of apocalyptic, after all, is a strong reversal of events between their perception by humanity and their perception in the heavenly realm. We are persecuted to death. We win the victor's crown. The bitter irony of Silverberg's short story is that throughout the narrative, current events keep interrupting, and it becomes obvious that the reason none of them saw the end of mankind as one of the possible future ends of the world is that they are themselves witnessing the end of mankind right now without even realising it. At the end of the story, the protagonist's wife says she wants to go and see the end of the world all over again, and he laughs quite a good deal. Were we in his shoes, we would pray a good deal and look up to heaven. As Augustine said, we are an Easter people, and hallelujah is our song.
I hope you've enjoyed this podcast from Faith and Thought. Next year's symposium will be on the 18th of October, and we'll look at the important subject of homosexuality from biblical, scientific, and pastoral aspects. So we look forward to seeing you there if possible.